On this episode, I'm in conversation with Brad Mellor. Welcome to another episode of the QI Guy in Conversation. I'm really excited about the episode that we've got for you today with Brad Mellor. Brad has a background in kind of engineering, so his kind of breadth and depth around quality and quality assurance and quality control kind of far exceeds healthcare. So we're talking about manufacturing, we're talking about kind of the automotive industry and the sweet industry. Brad then also interestingly retrained as a teacher, and because of his expertise and kind of quality control and quality improvement, get involved in that side of things in education, and through retraining had his eyes open to the possibilities of applying his skills in healthcare, and that's where we find them. So we have a kind of very broad discussion, and I was really excited because I wanted to explore how QI quality is approached in these different industries and where the similarities and differences are. And I think we cover that a wee bit, certainly enough to give us a sense of where some of those similarities and differences might lie. But Brad was one of the guys that responded to that shout out I did on Twitter, the way that Pete did in an early episode. So I was really happy when Brad did that, and I was even more so when we had the conversation, because I think there's some real good nuggets in there for us all to kind of take away and reflect on and steal shamelessly. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Brad. Okay, welcome back to the podcast, and I'm delighted to be joined by Bradley Mellor, who has been the second guest so far in this bunch of episodes that responded to a call out on Twitter for folk to come on and have a chat with me about quality improvement and everything in that sphere. So I was delighted to get a message from Bradley and really excited to have this conversation. How are you doing, sir?
Yeah, I'm doing good, thank you.
Excellent. Looking forward to this one. Yeah, no, as we were just saying there a moment ago, it tends to be the conversations that I have where are either with people who are working or have worked in healthcare or out with, and you're fairly unique so far in the kind of 25, 26 episodes I've done, and that you actually kind of transcend that kind of spectrum of working, you know, manufacturing industry and health, but also education as well. So I'm really keen to kind of dig into some of that experience and some of the differences. And I'm sure lots of people working in healthcare and public services and kind of quality and improvement and change would be quite keen to learn that. So let's just kick off. I mean, a very impressive biography you shared with me, Bradley. I was quite a wee bit intimidated, kind of like, oh, This is the kind of, you know, this is the master, this will be the student, the master. You've got a really extensive background in quality improvement. I mean, do you want to just kind of talk us through a bit of your journey?
Sure. Thank you for the compliment. I'm always learning. I don't see myself as the master. I'm always, there's always more to learn. I'm even learning as we speak now on different programs. There's always something that you can always learn from different people. My background originally was an apprentice trained engineer. I worked in engineering. I started off manufacturing parts, which is where it was quite interesting. I got to the end of my apprenticeship doing a lot of CNC machining. And when you're doing that sort of work, it's either complex work that's highly toleranced, especially in the automotive world, or you're producing lots of them, which again comes into tolerancing, et cetera, which quality control, SPC, is a massive thing in terms of what we're looking at there, limits and fits, making sure things work. So that's really interesting from that perspective. So I suppose I started really early on with quality control as that background. Mm-hmm. I worked my way through to, once I knew how to make parts, to becoming a project engineer, design engineer, and then a project manager. And I moved into the engineering sphere in terms of a lot of special purpose machines and production lines in food, and then automotive, coming back to automotive again. And it's really interesting from the background of the automotive stuff, again, because when you're looking at the tolerances and the quality management systems these people have, it's pretty unbelievable. And one thing from the food is around good old M&S. Their process and their quality inspection is absolutely phenomenal compared to some of the others that I've seen, because they protect the brand so well. And okay. The quality inspection they do is really spot on. So quite a lot of involvement in the engineering machinery design of it, project management. And then I moved into more manufacturing, and the manufacturing side of things came. And because I was doing all the machinery, and it was like, I'd actually like to get to manufacturing side of this because it's very interesting. And then you're looking into producing thousands upon thousands of components, which is a whole different ballgame again. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you're looking at there, and one thing in particular was when I moved to help with building products, I was doing 4 sites across the UK, which was great for variety in terms of mass manufacturing of things like plumbing fittings that are plastic injection molded through to huge clear pipes that you see in these big housing estates, massive range. And the thing about this was, I was really lucky because at that time I was doing like a greenfield site on all of them. They'd just start their journeys, and that was really exciting. And that was things like doing some 5S work to start off with, get people in the right mindset and just testing and probing that they were able to learn from that and apply it and sustain it. So I've been very lucky in that aspect. And again, when you're looking at these productions and you're looking at quality improvement projects, even back then there was a lot of around cost. And because when you're looking at production lines, some of these production lines were costing at least £10,000 per day if they were shut down. So when you're doing improvement work on them, and some of this included some redesign of parts, etc., it's a lot of pressure in terms of this has to be done, because if we overrun, there's a significant financial cost. Mm-hmm. And one of the other interesting things from that perspective is also around the cost. So if you're doing an improvement project back in those days, you had a 2-year payback. So if you couldn't pay it back, you wouldn't do it. Right, so it was pretty interesting, that perspective. So what I realised was, I then went on to Haribo, as it happens, and that's when I looked at a slightly different side, which was around the maintenance of the machines and making sure they're available, because they are mass manufacturing suites all day, every day, shifts, everything. So it's quite a high pressure in terms of when machines don't work or aren't available, it can impact significantly. So it introduced the total productive maintenance side of Lean into Haribo, which was an interesting one. And I was very lucky to have a mentor there who'd worked at Bird's Eye for a lot of years. He was a German, and he really took me under his wing and helped me and mentored me through that process. So as I was doing this sort of work, I was getting more and more and more involved in the training side of things. So I decided that, you know, maybe I could be a better trainer if I learned how to become a teacher. Mm-hmm. So ironically, I ended up taking the decision to leave, and I trained as a secondary school teacher. Yeah. And the early parts was just doing the normal teaching stuff. And the interesting thing about the education world has been that they are very data driven. It mm-hmm. is a very data driven process, and there's lots and lots of regulation, which we'd mm-hmm. expect. So the tracking and monitoring, and when people are inside or outside the limits in terms of their progress, is scrutinized to a minute detail. So mm-hmm. that was very interesting. And then because of my background in manufacturing, engineering, project management, I got involved in an awful lot of external work across the boroughs. And that was because government introduced new initiatives, new vocational initiatives. And because of my background, it fitted perfectly. So I had a very rich experience in that field. I managed to get promoted, got to the management side of things. Then I got into the board level at Director of Engineering Assistant Head, where I was working in Specialist Engineering College. And again, that was a really interesting part of things from QI and innovation, because again, you've got this CNC machining that you're doing with students, you've got the tolerances, quality control, quality management systems, but then you've also got this new innovation side around like 3D printing, which mm-hmm. is huge. So from an innovation point of view, QI and the Lean perspective, the waste on these processes is absolutely minimal. Mm-hmm. It's also a lot quicker. You can also do things in terms of looking at the strengths of these parts. So you are completely minimizing weight, which when you're looking at lean, what can we do without? How can we reduce the weight on this? And when you're thinking about sustainability, when you're looking at parts on aircraft, for example, if you can reduce the weight of those through 3D printing, through removing the waste, you then have the sustainable impact. So you've got the innovation, QI and sustainability, which is a big thing with NHS Green Plan now.
Absolutely.
So I also, though, in that time, my old lecturer from my university days when I got my degree, so I'm a chartered manufacturing system engineer, and I did a degree in manufacturing system engineering, which was completely amazing. And I did that part-time, which was quite an interesting time, especially when a young baby as well. So it was a very full-on time, was that. So I was lucky to become chartered. And as a result of this, I got asked to do some guest lecturing and show some of the case studies that I'd done by applying this. So there was an MSc in operations management, and they did a lean module. And I used to go up and guest lecture at Leeds Beckett University for a little bit, which I really enjoyed. And it was great to meet the students. So what then happened was, as I was, again, because of my background, I was asked to go out and meet with people from industry, because a special engineering college, go and, you know, bring them in. So we give as real a life experience to students as possible. And as I got through these, people were saying, why are you in education when you've got all this background? It'd be really, you know, and it sowed the seed again. So it's just one of those things, you know, and this is just the way some people's minds work. And my wife, I've got a fantastic wife, a very understanding and supportive wife. So I thought, okay, so do I want to do Six Sigma? Do I want to go into Lean? What do I want to do? Fortunately, my brother-in-law is a very successful Lean consultant in Australia and helped build a huge consultancy. So I gave him a call and said, you know, what do you think, Matt? And he said, well, it's Cardiff University, where the Lean Enterprise Research Centre was, where, you know, there's John Buscino, there's also Dan Jones that's been involved. So, you know, the big hitters, big names in this. So I thought, right, I'll have a look at that. Because I considered the Master Black Belt training. He said, Kit, stay clear of it, just because of your background. You know, have a look at this. So contacted Cardiff, said, no, we don't do that anymore. You might want to contact Buckingham University, which I did. So I contacted Buckingham, said, look, this is my background. And they said, it's 2 years, it's part-time, you'll have to fund it yourself, and you won't be spending much time in university. So you've got expenses to pay because you'll be flying around Europe to different award-winning sites, so Shingle award-winning sites, to learn from them. We're going to fly experts in from all over the world to work with you. And fortunately, my wife said, okay, let's do this then, and back me, which was fantastic. Wow. So I spent 2 years traveling around different sites in Europe, so from Latvia to Cork Island, to give you an example of the extent and the range. And it was an amazing experience, because it was complete practical application. And the other thing as well was, you were working on real problems. So you're basically becoming a consultant overnight, whilst being mentored by some of these amazing people that are, you know, leading. So I just find myself incredibly lucky. And one of the things that I was doing was looking in healthcare, because I thought this is where I'd like to be, because I think it's fascinating, healthcare. And also, as you know, as I've been a patient on a number of occasions and seen and thought, you know, there's better ways, there's surely better ways. And I thought, I'm going to focus on healthcare. So I focused on improvement science in healthcare and the evolution of it and what's happened, where it's come from, how it's developed. So that gave me my MSc. And as I was finishing my dissertation, I managed to see a job advert at my local trust. And I thought, I'm going to be cheeky, I'm going to give him a call. So I gave him a call and said, Mike, who is there? Mike Lewis said, Mike, I'm Brad, and this is my background. And I said, I'm being a bit cheeky, what do you think? And he went, no, please apply, says, because people from outside the NHS, different view.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that led me to where I am now, actually. I'm now in my third year in the NHS. So it's been, but by the way, my wife has worked in the NHS since she left college. She's a midwife, and she's, so I have a little bit of an insight into the NHS from her view. So that's been quite useful, and she's a great sounding board as well.
Wow. I know you said at the start you weren't a master, but I'm going to leave our listeners to decide, make up their own minds, because that was quite the journey. Brad, a lot of kind of ground covered there, and you said you were lucky. I can sense and feel a lot of hard work and a lot of dedication there as well. I want to take you back to the kind of the industry side, because as I'd mentioned, I was kind of keen to kind of
lean into some of the differences. You kind of almost said that, you know, from the get-go, you get into this kind of stuff and you were looking at SPC and tolerances and limits around the kind of engineering side of things. You know, how kind of integrated and essential is that type of thinking into training an engineer, for example, or training somebody that's working in that kind of industry? Is it kind of a real kind of part of your education into that role, or is it something that you do, you know, once you're in the workplace, they say, oh, and by the way, as well as all the engineering stuff, there's this quality business that we do?
It's integrated. So when you look at what happens with the parts, so the parts are an integral part of a machine. If you get into the tolerance and the tolerance is wrong, then what will happen is you could end up jamming that machine. So okay. there was a case with, I'm not going to mention the manufacturers, but these were automotive manufacturers. And what happened was they found on this gearbox that the cars, they weren't lasting that long and the gearboxes were breaking and failing. So they called people in to look at it, and these people just happened to be Japanese experts and said, we're not quite sure what's happening here. So when they went and did a sample and checked the manufacturing and checked the gears that were in the gearboxes and the different components, they actually found that the tolerancing was near the outer limits.
Yeah.
So when you're looking at things like coefficient of expansion in different metals, when you get to the edge of that limit, whilst it might seem acceptable because it's within the limits, it actually meant that in certain conditions it would lead to failure.
Yeah.
So when you're getting towards the, you know, what it should be without the tolerance, when they looked at different manufacturers, especially some of our Japanese counterparts, they found that their basic machine was close to that tolerance as was physically possible. And then, of course, very similar gearbox, no failures. So the focus on the limits and fits and the quality management system, the sampling and the checking, because you're making these parts, repeating these parts, is absolutely key. And they're coming from stable processes as well. And when I say stable, you know, this is a machine that will produce widget A over and over and over. Your discrepancies in terms of, if you were to look at the Six Sigma field and the design of experiments, you would look at tooltip wear. Because tooltip wear, once it wears, especially if you machine in a very strong metal such as Incoloy, it can wear quickly. And if you don't monitor that, you don't watch and monitor that, then you can soon see that you will have discrepancies in your tolerancing, which, when these things are spinning at high speed, can impact significantly.
That's really interesting. It's interesting to hear that it's integrated, and we'll maybe pick up on that when we talk about education and health in a wee minute. So you'd also mentioned, you know, kind of quality and manufacturing, but you're working in different kind of sectors. You've mentioned kind of automotive, and you've mentioned sweets and food and different things like that. Do you notice a kind of a different culture or a different approach or a different way it's viewed within those different products that are being manufactured within that space? Or is there a kind of a shared culture and understanding of the importance of that?
I think it's an interesting one. And one of the things that, when you look at engineering, because you've got situations where in machinery there can be failures, and if these failures, you know, involve people, then that's an absolute no. That things have to be safe to fail. So the integration when you're designing parts, especially if they're critical, you have to include safety factors because they have to be safe to fail. And, you know, when you're looking at, you know, beam deflections, for example, on a building, it's allowed to flex, never recall, it's about one on 360th of its span. So these things are integrated into the training of the engineers. When you get into the manufacturing side of things, you know, when you're looking at the food market, when you've got things like check weighers, that as you weigh sweets and you put them into the bags, and you've got these vertical bagger machines which go at a very quick pace, you know, the quality control and the checking is done at such speed that when you see these blurs, all of a sudden you'll see, for example, in Coca-Cola, they're just blurs because they're going so quick, but they will have a system which will automatically flick off anything that is not within tolerance. It is that impressive in terms of the engineering, in terms of the software that's behind this, that's controlling all of this.
Okay, right. Yeah. So software, not automation, a big part of it. You know, part of why I was excited to have this conversation with Brad was about those kind of differences when then you're thinking about quality improvement and you know, how does that translate into education and health? Being somebody that's kind of went through that, you know, what are the similarities and differences in terms of, even if we take some of the, you know, your wife being a midwife, if we go with that in terms of her profession, do you see kind of quality and a focus on, say, QMS and quality improvement kind of baked in and integrated into their education? And how do you see that kind of translate now that you're working in health in terms of maybe how some of those staff on the ground understand those health tolerances, if you like, if we're kind of relating that?
I think it's really interesting because one of the elements of training, it's something we've discussed this week, is around QI projects, and they do the QI mm-hmm. projects as part of their training. Yeah. ACP's doing it. So it is there in that training at the inset of it. And it's really interesting around that there are posts within maternity for quality, because one of the things that, you know, safe to fail is what we want. You know, we want every patient to have a great experience, effective, safe care. And these things are drilled into people. This is what people join NHS to do. They want mm-hmm. to provide the best patient experience. In terms of quality, it's really interesting when you look at the evolution of it in the NHS. So if you go back to the 2000s when you had Bolton doing their piece, and one of the things that I've reflected on as preparation for this was around lean has come on quite a long journey. And, you know, I remember lean is mean, you know, and it's one of those things where when you reflect back on it, it was, because when you were cost cutting, and it was used aggressively for cost cutting in certain areas.
Yeah.
You know, it's not got the greatest of name. And when you look at people, and one of the great quotes, there's two great quotes that stick with me, and they've stuck with me since I heard them. Number one is John Seddon, and he said, "Beware of the tool heads." And what he was meaning there was somebody will say, "Here's this tool, it will solve your problem."
Yeah.
And his view on this, and this is the view I take now, because I think it's a great view, it's not mine, it's his, is that only use the tool if it's been designed for the problem that you're trying to solve. And if it's not, then please don't use it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got the more modern take on that, which is Bobby Miliani, who calls things fake lean.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, what this is where we've had people trying to do things with the best of intentions, but it's not always worked in the way that it was intended.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where, when you look at the publication of The Machine That Changed the World, which was back in the early 90s, by Womack and Jones, they then published Lean Thinking, because even back then they were seeing things in terms of the interpretation of what they'd created, which was a phenomenal piece. And I think where we are now in terms of healthcare and applying it, it's in a great place. You know, in terms of, if you look at the trusts across the country, if you look at the Virginia Mason pilot recently, the way that it's been embraced by people, the way that it's changed the way they've worked. You know, there's Leeds Teaching Hospitals right near where I work, which, you know, have had the VMI experience. You look at people down, so for example, at University Hospital Sussex, that have done absolutely fantastic. There's so many trusts that are doing great things with QI and embedded it. You know, so for me, the QI experience within the NHS is one where there's some fantastic examples. There really is. And at our trust, we were involved with North East Transformation Service before my time. And what's been really interesting is the way that people talk here. I've just had a meeting just prior to this, and they were talking about, you know, we want inch wide, mile deep, and we want to do an RPIW. And that is just to show you the culture and how that's been weaved into what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's something that I wanted to kind of touch on, was the kind of similarities or differences in terms of culture. You know, I certainly see that healthcare's come on leaps and bounds over the decade or so that I've kind of been involved in kind of quality in healthcare. You know, and coming from a a healthcare background and kind of almost looking out and seeing, you know, how are we doing compared to, you know, aviation or manufacturing. And it's there, it's starting to get there. I don't think it's quite there. You kind of watch your limited experience in terms of how that cultural piece is. Again, you know, it's, you've touched on some of this. It seems to be really kind of integrated in kind of, you know, engineering and manufacturing. But, you know, how do you see that coming through in healthcare? Is it still kind of person dependent, or are we getting to that point where the culture and the mindset around how we understand safety, how we understand how the system's performing and therefore make the right decisions to move forward? Do you see that kind of going maybe for more a command and control performance, get this happening, you know, yesterday, to more of that kind of understanding piece and more of a kind of set methodology? And I love that quote around the kind of, you know, beware the show heads, because again, my experience in healthcare is that we don't often spend the time to really understand what's happening, and therefore we have a toolkit, so we just start applying the tools to maybe a less than full knowledge of what's going on, and therefore, yeah, some of the tools might not actually fulfill their purpose, and that can turn folk off. So yeah, a bit of a mixed bag in there, but you know, kind of that culture mindset piece, you know, how do you see the differences there, see that kind of developing?
It's interesting to mention command and control, because John Seddon, referring back to John Seddon, his titles are Freedom from Command and Control and Beyond Command and Control. So it's quite ironic.
Excellent.
You know, when you look at that within healthcare contacts and my limited time in there, there is a time and a place for command and control. Absolutely. You know, we look at what happened in COVID, and it started out, but you know, pretty much in terms of, we were learning as we were going along, and sometimes there's that need for command and control. But then the way that the trust that I'm at, from what I've seen, the way they adapted was absolutely phenomenal in terms of the safety, the way the teams work together, you know, keeping patients safe, making sure that we were offering slots for patients, the accommodation from the teams on the ground. And we were in there, we were called in by the person running it, Claire, and she was fantastic. You know, she completely embraced what we were doing. She wanted to improve flow. You know, the trust wanted to do the best they possibly could. When we did it, that was with the external patients. When we were doing it with our staff, exactly the same focus. It was that real passion driving forward. We want this to be the way that we're working. We want to work as effectively and efficiently as we can. It was all there. And across the wards as well. You know, it's very humbling to see the way that the staff at our trust work. I am in awe of them, because they take these situations, they handle them, they do a really good job, you know, and we don't get everything right all the time. It would be fantastic if we could, but we're not dealing with a machine that would churn out widgets day in, day out. Healthcare Absolutely. Is one of the most complex systems in the world. And, you know, the way that staff handle things on a day-to-day basis is impressive. Is there ways we can improve? Absolutely. I mean, our previous CEO, when I joined the trust, was really big. We did lots and lots of RPIWs. We were really driving forward. Our new CEO has been fantastic in taking that forward with the systems working, which means looking at, you know, different teams. So when you're looking at working across on the ward and what that means, so for example, at one of our hospitals, we, and this is a great example of our CEO being on the ground, listening to the staff, he was talking to some consultants about how it was doing in one of our urgent treatment centres, and they said, well, we're trying to find stuff and it's taking time and we want to make sure we're, you know, we as much time with patients as we can. So he came straight to my team and said, can you go and help them? And we did an amazing piece of work there. And the teams were so receptive. They really enjoyed, well, we really enjoyed working with them, and they enjoyed working with us. We got a video case study of it. It was such a nice piece of work to do, because the culture was there. You know, the culture's there. You know, and it's one of those where we always say that when we go into a team, we've got to engage the staff. Mm-hmm. And when you've got a CEO and the board on their walk around doing the go see, that are engaged with the consultants and then taking that, closing that loop and using that to make sure that, well, we've got an issue here. So I tell you what, we know that it's a busy treatment centre. Let's get the KPO team, the MyQuiz team in to help and support them. And we didn't take them out of a classroom. We didn't take them into a classroom. We actually went on the ground with them. And the way they manage that area is fantastic.
Yeah, I think that's really important. Some teams, you just need to kind of be immersed in that. But the shop floor, the clinic, the ward, whatever it is. And I think that's also really key as well. There's you know, that phrase that kind of, you know, improvement is kind of 80% relational and those relationships and 20% the tools. And again, the more that I kind of work in quality improvement across different systems, that relationship and that ability to engage with staff and understand, but also kind of have that relationship to translate the technical stuff, it's so important. And it absolutely is, you know, that 80 and 20 together gives you the 100%, and it's not to kind of reduce or dismiss the kind of the technical tools. And it's also interesting, I started this podcast during the pandemic, because we were at home and we had some free time. You know, the pandemic has been such a platform for kind of a kind of escalation of QI across the system, because people who were either not aware and not involved, or maybe were slightly dismissive, were all of a sudden having to make massive changes. And whether it was lean or whether it was the kind of associates for process improvement, whatever that methodology that was being used, was now kind of vital to how they set up red and green zones or whatever in their hospitals, or how they looked at flow so that patients didn't mix, or looked at their vaccination centres that were all being set up in testing centres, etc., etc. All of a sudden, people were really interested in things like flow and lean and, you know, testing and learning and learning systems and all this kind of stuff. So it's often, it's unfortunate that it often needs a crisis, Brad. It needs something, you know, really kind of drastic to happen, like a global pandemic, or, you know, and healthcare, we've often seen, you know, things like mid-staff where there's, you know, there's really, really terrible things happening at scale. And, you know, in healthcare, it's not about money or a production line being shut down. It's often, you know, people not receiving the care or ultimately, sadly, kind of losing their lives. And it is a shame that needs to happen to kind of get us on, but I'm sure anyone listening to this working in healthcare and quality improvement will be kind of having those things going through their mind, those different kind of milestones. Listen, thanks for having this chat. As we kind of wrap up here, I want you to kind of share, I mean, what's your top tips for improvement, you know, kind of taking in the kind of spectrum of your experience, you know, what should people be thinking about when they see a problem and they want to kind of change and improve that, whatever level of the system they're in?
I think you alluded to that one of the most important things, and the latest research that's come out of Warwick Business School on the NHS VMI partnership. We weren't one of the five major trusts, but we actually worked for Virginia Mason during one of those years. Mm-hmm. And that was very enlightening for us. What it is, one of Dr. Nicola Burgess's infographics is six elements for building improvement capability. Number four is social connectedness and technical mm-hmm. capability. And what you alluded to there, it doesn't matter how technically capable a person is with the tools, if the social relationships and connectedness isn't there, it's not going to work. Mm-hmm. The other one as well is, and this has been an interesting one, is around the root cause problem solving. So, you know, when we're looking at problems, one of the things that we say, and we go through a process at the trust, is, are you looking at the symptom or are you looking at the problem? And how do you know?
Yeah.
So we have a robust, we use eight-step problem solving, A3 thinking, and that's our framework, what we use all the time. If it's the smaller ones, then we adhere to the PDSA cycles. Mm-hmm. And that depends on the size of the problem. And we always say, there's certain ways to deal with things. One of the great things that we learned from Virginia Mason was the everyday lean ideas about engaging with staff. empowering them and enabling them then to have the opportunity to put their ideas forward, but then having that process through an everyday lean idea to basically have a system for them to contribute to their areas, and they have the autonomy to do that. And then that creates a sense of belonging. So that for me is, has been to wrap up in a very short, concise piece.
Yeah, we're looking for snackable content here. I'm sure people will be listening to this on their commute, or perhaps their lunch break, or maybe they're out a wee walk. So yeah, really, really good points, really good tips. And I absolutely, you know, there's always going to be somebody in your system who is a quality improvement person, professional. So don't worry about the technical tools, because there'll be somebody there to help you. It is that relational side of things. Absolutely. And you'll know as well as I do, and people listening will know, that often when teams have a problem or issue and aren't making the kind of improvement progress you would like to, it's usually the dynamics within the team and the relationships and how that's been managed at the outset can set the tone going forward. So you can have all the lovely A3 templates and driver diagrams and process maps, but ultimately if people aren't getting on, or at least having that kind of respect and kind of collegiate discussion, you're on a hiding to nothing, as my mother would say to me. So Brad, thank you very much for your time today. This has been really fantastic, and we'll put your bio, and if you any links to things that we've discussed here, we'll stick that in the show notes. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
So all that's left for me to do is thank you once again for listening to the podcast, and make sure you kind of like and subscribe, and if you feel inclined, why not leave a little review wherever you get your podcasts. I am reliably told it does help the algorithm. I don't know if that's going to help me get any fancy charts or anything like that when you open up your Apple Podcast app, for example, but I would appreciate any support you could offer. Make sure you're also following us on Twitter, at the QI_guy, where we'll obviously be announcing kind of upcoming episodes and continuing to share and have debates about all things QI. So until next time, take care. Thank you to Brad for giving us his time. That was a fantastic conversation, a really insightful conversations, showing perhaps some of the differences and similarities of QI in different industries, quite radically different industries. Brad spoke there about, obviously, cars and food and the production of that, and quality and the context of that, and education and then healthcare. So really, really varied. So thank you once again, Brad, for your time, and I hope you all enjoyed that. We're doing a wee bit of a giveaway on the QI Guy Twitter channel, at the QI_guy. You can find that. Up for grabs is a copy of a fantastic book by Daniel Coyle called The Culture Code. All you have to do to be in with a chance of winning that during the month of June is find the pinned tweet on our profile and give it your like and your retweet. And we will randomly select a winner at the end of June to receive a copy of that book. And once we've selected you, we'll be in touch. But make sure you do that. It's free to enter. If you have a Twitter account, it's free. And all it's going to take you is two taps on your phone or your device, and you're going to be in with a chance of winning that book. And we're going to have monthly giveaways of books throughout the rest of the year. So take full advantage of that.